Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. And I'm joined this week by critics Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, Leo Lowenstein, and Charles Solomon, film critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. It's a really big week for films. At least on paper, a number of them look like they hold promise. We're going to find out whether they deliver. And we begin with The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. It's a prequel to The Hunger Games series, and we follow the character of Coriolanus Snow years before he would become a tyrant. The film stars Tom Blythe, Rachel Zegler, Jason Schwartzman, Peter Dinklage, and more. Lael, what did you think of this Hunger Games prequel?
So at 2.5 hours, it is very long and sometimes unwieldy, but in the hands of director Francis Lawrence, who did three of the other four films in the series, I think fans will like it. It delivers mostly the high notes that you expect from a film of this sort. It shows how Coriolanus could be turned from an innocent, wide-eyed, optimistic young man who believes in the good of humanity to someone who becomes a dangerous authoritarian figure and eventually the evil leader of Pan Am. It's generally well-acted. I thought Rachel Zegler as the young songbird of interest and Blythe are very strong, but again, without Jennifer Lawrence, it's not quite the same thing. It doesn't have the charisma of an actress like that. And you do have Viola Davis as a baddie. You also have Peter Dinklage, Jason Schwartzman, practically born to play the kooky narrator of the TV events and the Hunger Games as they are introduced. It's successful in some ways, but again, over the top, feels way too long and could have been broken up really realistically into probably two films.
Oh, no.
No, not for you, Tim?
No.
Why not? Don't want to see any more of
it. Oh my goodness.
What do you think?
Look, these movies, I've never liked these movies.
Even with Jennifer Lawrence?
Come on.
I like Jennifer Lawrence in these movies. The theme of these movies, I don't like. The very foundational notions in the book, the movies, whatever, were these children killing each other for these reasons. I had hoped to like this movie because it's a prequel, that it will establish things in such a way that it will make all of those other movies, the very theme of the films themselves, more tolerable to me. I find all of this offensive, to be frank. But it didn't. It really, really didn't. And yeah, it's mostly about Coriolanus. I was asking Charles, I wonder how Shakespeare would feel about that.
He's busy turning.
In his grave. But there it is. This takes the Hunger Games have already been going on for 10 years when this takes place. Yet it's still 65 or so years before the Hunger Games that we know. And they do all kinds of really interesting things to suggest the past and the future. The arena, I guess, is what they call it. It's mostly just rubble. But those little platforms that they stand on in the very extravagant games, you know, they're just these little discs now in this game. And I like all of that in the movie. But I don't know. I think that there's a certain kind of person who, when they consider what this is actually about, the things that we're actually watching, what's actually going on in this movie, these children set to killing each other for these reasons, conceived and, you know, and whatever they are. I don't know. But then again, I never liked Lord of the Flies either.
Right.
I'm sorry.
I think there is a message here and in Suzanne Collins' work that, you know, this is what can become of us in an unchecked sort of situation where, you know, you put too much trust in your authority figures, or you trust that, you know, people who are looking out for you say they have your best interests at heart. And then, you know, look what one thing can lead to another. And before you know, kids are killing each other.
There's a context. There's a context, certainly. The result of that context, I do not buy. I do not buy it philosophically for one second.
We're talking about The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, a prequel in the Hunger Games series Francis Lawrence directed. It's written by Michael Leslie and Michael Arndt, rated PG-13 in wide release. The animated musical Trolls Band Together, the latest entry in that series of films. Walt Dorn and Tim Heitz are the directors. Elizabeth Tippett wrote the screenplay. Charles.
This is the third installment in the Trolls franchise, so it's not surprising it has all the individuality and inspiration of a Big Mac. instead, we're getting backstory here, this time on the Justin Timberlake character Branch, and he was once part of a boy band known as Brozone. They broke up when he was a little, still in diapers or made to pose in diapers, look younger than he was. One of his brothers has been kidnapped by these fake singers who are somehow drawing his talent out when they're singing, although they sound nothing like him. And they have to reunite the brothers and go on the rescue and get a life lesson. And this very quickly reestablishes all the elements of the franchise now geared up with what the latest level of software can do. The day-glow, garish colors with buckets full of glitter everywhere. The needle-drop 80s and 90s soundtrack that's ramped up and pumped up and processed. And, oh, here's 10 seconds of Sweet Dreams are made of this. Here's 15 seconds of The Hustle. Here's 10 seconds of Staying Alive. All done to this kind of TikTok editing pace. There's a definite shape language in place. It's butt ugly, but it's consistent. And then you have the same characters again. Poppy never shuts up until you're ready to slap her. And Timberlake's character is the best acted and the best animated. But once it sets up all those things, it never stops. Mm. The adjective for this movie is relentless. Oh. And I came out of it feeling like I was crawling out of a rugby scrum.
That's brutal. And I'm so glad you didn't harm a troll as bad as you. We don't want any troll slapping.
But how are the
here.
Songs? Are there any good songs?
Oh, look, there's 70s, any number of 70s, 80s, and
so
90s.
So these are
soundtrack.
Like the grandparents of the kids going to see the film. Yeah,
they do Casey and the Sunshine Band, Keep It Coming Low. I think it's like 1976. Or something like that, if I'm not
mistaken. When was The Hustle?
Yeah, 70s as well. This is the disco era.
And they're killing it. I'm look, first 3 minutes of this movie, there's a poop, a pee, and a fart joke. The kids in this room went bananas. Every single one of them just couldn't. They were uncontrollable, and it was kind of that way for the rest of the movie. Now, what Charles says is that this movie does not stop. For 1 second, there's not a moment of silence in this film. And I think that's on purpose. It moves fast. The sort of shapes and forms. So they do this thing, Charles, and maybe you can explain this to me. They do it well. There are characters that are gigantic, big characters, tall. And then, of course, we have these tiny little trolls and everything in between. But somehow they make it feel like all of these disparate shapes and forms do and can live in these spaces, these animated spaces. What is going on there? How do they make that work?
That's designers coming up with a shape language and then applying it to all the members of the cast. So they had the trolls to begin with, and then they push some of those same shapes in kind of a Betty Boop direction for the tall characters who are all going to that weird nightclub, amusement park, rave thing in the second half of the movie. So it's, again, design at work. It's very coherent. It's just ugly.
Yeah. Gentlemen, I so appreciate you took one for the team on this. Thank you very much. Trolls Band Together. Walt Dorn, Tim Heitz, and the directors. Rated PG-13, the third of the Trolls franchise films in wide release. Next Goal Wins is co-written and directed by Taika Waititi, who I'll be talking with later this hour on Film Week. He, of course, did Jojo Rabbit, for which he won the Best Adapted Screenplay Oscar. Next Goal Wins tells the story of the American Samoan soccer team as it's trying to qualify for the 2014 World Cup. And more than a decade prior to that, they'd suffered the worst loss in World Cup qualifying history, 31-0, or nil, as they say, to Australia. Michael Fassbender stars as the coach brought in to right the national team ship. Elizabeth Moss plays his estranged wife, and Oscar Keitley in the cast as well. Tim, what do you think of Next Goal Wins?
So this is interesting. There are many charming moments in this movie, and a lot of funny stuff. I happen to find Taika kind of a funny guy. He's in the film.
Beginning and end, yes.
Doing all kinds of wacky things. And I describe this as Ted Lasso, if Ted Lasso was an ass. And you didn't like him for a big chunk of that series.
Yeah, it's kind of the anti-Lasso.
It's the anti-Lasso. Yeah. So this guy, who Michael is playing,
he's based on a real figure.
Figure. We see him in the film. The suggestion is that he wasn't that great of a coach, and they send him off to coach this team full of these American Samoan players, not Samoa, not international Samoa.
Different places.
It's a different place, and it's a big deal, and they make sure you know in this movie. And he has all these sort of interesting people who live in a very interesting way, a different way than obviously Australia, probably here in America too, and have a different way of approaching everything in life. And he has to adjust. There's all sorts of things that are going on, dramatic things. Yeah. We're gonna learn as we work our way through this movie. Mostly, it's charming and funny. 31-0. That was hard.
It's not as sort of wacky as some of the other YTV films, but some of his humor certainly gets in where he comments on popular culture. Leo, what do you think of Next Goal Wins?
Well, I was mixed on it. I thought there were very endearing moments and some really decent performances, chief among them by someone named Kaimana, who plays Jaya, who was the first transgender soccer player to compete in a World Cup qualifying match. And I thought their performance was excellent.
Yeah, the actor is very good.
Yes. And there's a lot of sort of tenderness with regard to that relationship and how that sort of comes to play in the story. It does have a lot of underdog sports cliches. Now, of course, every underdog sports movie is going to hit on many of the same moments. I mean, it just has to be, whether it's Rudy or Miracle or McFarlane USA or whatever it is. There's Rocky, you know, there's all these beats that you kind of have to hit. So I maybe got a little bit impatient sometimes, knowing that they were coming and feeling like I could anticipate a lot of those things. But for the most part, it's a very jovial, very upbeat film. Waititi has this sort of goofy way of playing with time and place and sort of your visual and stylistic expectations. And I thought that was well done here. He's a very whimsical director. So I thought it was mostly enjoyable.
Next Goal Wins, rated PG-13 in wide release. Dream Scenario, a film that has been out a week. Nicolas Cage, Julianne Nicholson, Michael Cera star in the film, which is written and directed by Christopher Borgli. Tim, what did you think of Dream Scenario?
I like this movie very much. I do. Nick Cage is this ordinary, kind of hapless professor of insect behavior, mostly ants, in this film. His name is Paul, and it's the most ordinary and demure character that Nick Cage has ever played ever in his entire career, ever. 40 years, this guy that he's playing. He has his young daughter, and his young daughter is the first, about 12 or 13, is the first one to see him in her dream. In which he appears. The dream is not about him, and he's not the subject of the dream at all, and he does nothing of consequence in this dream. And this event, this happening, starts to happen first in his community, across the country, across the world. People seeing Paul in their dream doing nothing of consequence. That nothing of consequence part starts to bug Paul. He's like, I don't do anything. And he decides that he wants to be consequential, at least in his real life. And he starts to play into the celebrity that would come with appearing in people's dreams. And people don't seem to be very bothered by him in their dreams. He's almost sort of a, you know, comforting figure in the dreams, because they know he's not going to do anything until he does. Oh. And then we get this other movie. And then Nick Cage, as he does, turns it up to 11. It's just exquisite. We always talk about, oh, Nick Cage is back. You know, Nick Cage has been back for like 20 years now. He had Pig and Willy's Wonderland, all of these movies over the last, you know, more than a decade. Now.
Many good performances.
Many good movies, good performances in movies even. So, yeah, this is very, very good, very interesting. Think about Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, or even better, Being John Malkovich, neither of which nail the landing to my mind. This one nails the landing.
Yeah, I'm a fan of both.
I love
both of those. Dream Scenario. Again, starring Nicolas Cage, Julianne Nicholson, Michael Cera, Christopher Borgli, the writer-director. It's rated R in select theaters. When we come back, Todd Haynes directing May-December, starring Natalie Portman, Julianne Moore, and Charles Melton. We'll find out about this film, also Leo and Saltburn from writer-director Emerald Fennell. That's all coming up on Film Week with our critics in just 1 minute.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Charles Solomon, Leah Lowenstein, and Tim Cogshell. Next up, director Todd Haynes' film May-December. It's written by Sammy Birch. It's in select theaters before streaming on Netflix starting next month. Leah, what did you think of the latest from Haynes?
I really thought this was excellent. It's Haynes is such a gifted director. You know, so many of his films have dealt with the issue of duality or appearance versus reality, whether it's Carol or whether it's the Far From Heaven one that he did. It's just tremendous that he's so gifted in dealing with these sort of humans and our need to tell each other stories and to tell ourselves stories and the duality between what is real and what is not real, and the fact that we often convince ourselves of things that are real. So that just gets to the fact that this is sort of inspired by the Mary Kay Letourneau story of, I don't know, some 20-something years ago, in which an older woman, in this case, she worked at a pet shop, has an affair with a much younger male individual, a 13-year-old, and they consummate their relationship eventually. She gets fired, she gets divorced, she gets socially ostracized, but they fell in love, they get married, they have kids, and so on and so forth. This takes place later. Natalie Portman is an actress who is playing the Julianne Moore character, and she has come to embed herself in their family and to do research on what it was like and why all these things happened. The fact that there is so much ambiguity in this about right and wrong and about that there, you know, emotion and its power to dominate over rational thinking and all of that, that is a thread throughout this film. I thought it was just tremendously well done, and it does sort of teeter on the verge of comedy at times, but it is a dramatic film to my mind.
What about Charles Melton's performance the husband?
Thank you for asking, Larry, because I thought he was excellent. He starts out, you think he's a little distant, a little maybe thick, or a little just sort of resigned, and then as the film moves along, he is just tremendous. He shows so many colors and nuances in his performance, and he has just a wonderful scene with his son, whose son's ready to go to college, on the roof of their house, and they're just talking about, you know, whether he's saying, I don't know if I'm creating bad memories for you, or if this is actually something you're going to hold on to, or if it's something you're going to resent me for. So it's just a wonderful performance.
I didn't have to ask you about Portman and Moore's performances, because of course they're always
good. Well,
Tim, what do you think of May-December?
I'm going to talk about their performances here. So Portman
and Moore have to do this very interesting thing. So because this is not the Mary Kay Letourneau story, it's shaped in this very particular way. So Julianne Moore creates this character that's somewhat like that. Not Julianne Moore, but Natalie Portman is this actress. She's this person, right? But she has to create a character that's just like the character that Julianne Moore has created. So by the time we get to the end of this movie, they're both acting this character. And Portman, this actress, is performing. But she's performing in this way that she's Julianne Moore. She has this, but Julianne Moore isn't being Julianne Moore. She's being this. So this is just this brilliant building and layering of characters. And you know, it makes me wonder if Portman and Julianne Moore had gotten together and say, okay, let's build this person. We're going to build this person. And slowly over the course of this movie, this actress is observing me.
And that's shown visually too, with the makeup and
the thing that she does with her lip. Julianne Moore has this thing that she does with her lip. That Natalie Portman can do with her lip, and it sends a chill through you, Melton, a child whose development was arrested when he was 13 years old, and he's 33 years old now, and his development is still arrested, and that's a thing that's being explored here. Mm-hmm. He's only now becoming a man. Thinking about
this sounds fascinating.
It's cringy.
Really good.
Score, everything in that score is like in a flat key, like you know, like A flat minor. It's just all just shocking.
Well, is that a send up of the TV movie of the week, Sean?
There was a Mary Kay Letourneau TV movie back. I can't remember who
even
was in
alluded
that.
To
in
that's
the
even
film.
Referenced
there was
in the
that
film.
There had been previously okay. a TV movie. Very interesting. Yeah.
May December from director Todd Haynes, screenplay from Sammy Birch. It's rated R. Again, it's in select theaters, but Netflix will start streaming it December 1st. Leo is an animated musical comedy featuring the voices of Adam Sandler, Bill Burr, Cecily Strong, Jason Alexander and more, Robert Smigel, Robert Marionetti, and David Wachtenheim are the directors of the film. Charles?
Well, this is cringy, but for a different reason. The only reason the first two Hotel Transylvania movies were as good as they are is they had Genndy Tartakovsky directing them, who was a brilliant director. We don't have him on this, and so we're kind of back to Eight Crazy Nights territory. Leo is a 74-year-old iguana who's been the mascot of a sixth-grade classroom for decades. And somehow he and the tortoise he's with in the terrarium can talk. He gets taken home by the different kids, and he gets to give each one a life lesson that is a cliche exemplified. You know, try asking a question. Maybe you're insecure. The songs are simply drivel, and the result is just painfully bad. If there's something worse than Adam Sandler trying to be funny, it's Adam Sandler trying to be touching, and he isn't, and cringing.
Leo, the animated musical comedy, is rated PG, and next Tuesday it starts streaming on Netflix. Saltburn is from writer-director Emerald Fennell. Barry Keoghan stars in the film, along with Jacob Elordi and Rosamund Pike. It's about an Oxford University student who finds himself getting into the world of aristocratic character who's also there. They go to the family estate Saltburn, and things happen. Tim, what'd you think of the film?
Well, this is an interesting film, and I like it because I liked it every time I've seen it. I liked it in 1999 when it was called The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Oh, yeah. Terrific film.
Yeah,
yes.
your Purple Noon in 1960.
Isn't it kind of Brideshead Revisited?
It's a little bit of that, a little bit, but also...
also an excellent
A touch of Cruel Intentions in Valmont and Dangerous Liaisons. And one of these kind of, is about the proletariat, about that powerful group, the aristocrats getting their comeuppance from the proletariat. Barry is fantastic in this movie. He really is wonderful. But he is really the thing that the film has to offer. All that is going to happen in this movie, all that does happen in this movie, you really actually have seen before. Yes, all of these people who are funny in their ways in this mansion, Saltburn. She shoots in 1:33, which is interesting because this is such an elaborate scale, this property, that you would think that she would 2:35, something in scope, you know? But no, she compresses it all down very, very tight, and it makes everything
everything very intense. She goes through these rooms. This is the blue room where the Relis are, and the Earl of this and the Duke of that, and all of these tight shots. Not to, these people are not attractive people, you know. And it's so that 133 makes sense for me. It's very familiar, is all. It's good, but familiar.
Saltburn, Lael.
So I think that those films that you mentioned earlier, Tim, all of them had a degree more kind of criticism, social criticism, that was interesting than what goes on here in Saltburn. While I think the film is visually sumptuous and striking, and Fennell does her thing with her trademark bold, weird colors and palettes and compositions and all of that, it doesn't feel like it has a lot of substance. And I don't really know why. But, you know, having seen and loved Promising Young Woman, which was a very strong and striking sort of
Oscar-nominated
film. Oscar-winning, for screenplay.
Yeah, you're right.
Revenge fantasy story. I kind of thought maybe this will be like that. I do think there's some really sharp dialogue. Rosamund Pike, in particular, has some zingers of lines. And there's some decent performances, you know, all the way around. Jacob Elordi from Euphoria is excellent.
Good
Barry
Lord,
Keoghan,
he's gorgeous.
He is gorgeous.
That's just ridiculous.
Barry Keoghan is always good as this sort of wounded, weird outsider guy. It almost reminded me of Killing of a Sacred Deer in certain ways, the film that he was in. And of course, you know, Richard E. Grant, God, like he was just born for this film.
Never go wrong.
But somehow the film just left me wanting more, like more substance or more criticism, more something. Beautiful to look at, weird, didn't leave me feeling much of anything.
Saltburn from writer-director Emerald Fennell is rated R. It's in select AMC theaters, and then it goes into wider release starting next Wednesday. The documentary, The Disappearance of Cher Height, looks back on the tremendous influence of her book, The Height Report, which was published in 1976 and really got the country talking about women's sexuality. Now, the scholarship in The Height Report was much criticized. I had an opportunity of interviewing her after the publication of that book a number of years later, but her impact was significant. This documentary attempts to get at that. Nicole Noonan is the director of The Disappearance of Cher Height. Lael, what'd you think?
To my mind, The Disappearance of Cher Height is one of the best documentaries of the year. It is a very well-researched, well-documented story that's frankly quite a tragedy in parts. So she was a beautiful, striking woman with this kind of cascading head of Pre-Raphaelite curls, red hair, beautiful red hair. She also worked as a model sometimes, but she went to school to study social sciences and then eventually sexology. She became a sexologist and researched and wrote The Height Report. And her methodology, as you said, Larry, was much criticized in that she didn't have a very wide sampling. She didn't have as many ways of reaching her subjects, perhaps, back then. But what she wrote was significant in terms of following up, building on Masters and Johnson and Kinsey and all of that, but also adding her own discoveries about women and sexuality. Later on, she went on to write a book about men and love, as well as women and love. And it was really the men and love book that I think became highly criticized, and particularly by men. And in this film, you see her getting ambushed on camera in certain interviews by, you know, Maury Povich, by other journalists, and by a group of men who become so incensed at her trying to tell them what men might think about masculinity and their reluctance to talk about it, that it is highly ironic. So in the end, it's very sad because she becomes almost a victim of the ideology that she is writing about, and it's perpetuated in any case. So, you know, I thought it was very, very well done. Very interesting story that taught me a lot.
We're talking about The Disappearance of Cher Height, the documentary. Tim, what did you think?
An extraordinary moment in the culture. The film is very good. good. It's very strong, this film, because it captures most of this, mostly because there's a great deal of footage of Cher height from many, many years before. Some of it owing to some of the professions that she was a model. She was ridiculously beautiful, this woman. And she had a master's degree from the University of Florida. Her name is Shirley. She was from St. Joseph's, Missouri. At the time, we all thought that she was an immigrant, perhaps from Germany or someplace like that. Mm-hmm. She had this very particular accent. She was born in St. Joe. And she did all of this extraordinary work mid-70s and early 80s. It was a moment in the culture that men in the culture were not ready for. The problem was men. I think I actually saw her when she was on Oprah. She's on Oprah and I think she's on Geraldo. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I saw it when she was on Geraldo. Geraldo kind of sandbagged her a little bit. Oprah was protective of her, but she let the men have their way in terms of she was the only woman there.
Yeah.
When she was on,
she had an audience
but men,
solely composed of men, and that was part of the issue there.
Yeah, and that was after her book on men's sexuality that men really took offense to. I was a very, very, very young man at that time. I didn't take offense to any of that, and I thought that Dr. Ruth would come along a little bit after her, and Dr. Ruth would be much, much more pointed about all of this than Cher Hite had been.
Yeah, but Dr. Ruth got away with stuff that no one before her
had. But Dr. Ruth called herself a sex therapist, I think, really, and a sex expert, whereas Cher Hite was, a researcher.
She was beautiful,
I think that was part of the problem, was the way she looked. And she was discredited because of that, I think.
Dr. Ruth had the force of personality.
Yeah.
This little old lady who's just talking
so blunt.
Like a bathroom
that's part
graffiti.
Of the appeal. The Disappearance of Cher Hite, the documentary's rated R. It's at AMC Burbank 16, and based on what you're both saying, this should be in more theaters. Mm-hmm. So hopefully people will go out and see the film. We have a music documentary this week, The Stones and Brian Jones. Lael, can you give us a quick take on this film?
Right. So I did not realize that Brian Jones was the co-founder of the Rolling Stones, and he was sort of the creative genius of the band. He didn't write the songs. Mick and Keith did, but he had a lot of the creative flourishes. What's really cool about this documentary is that there are interviews with Bill Wyman, with other musicians who talk about what kind of contribution Jones made creatively to the group, and I hadn't really been aware of that before. Jones, of course, died tragically. He drowned in a swimming pool in 1969. There were already some issues and some ruptures within the band, and they started to branch away from him, but it sort of became the struggle for control between whether it was going to be Brian's band or Mick and Keith's band, and that's where the trouble started. He also was a prolific adulterer. He wasn't married, though, but he had many children out of wedlock, many. So there you go.
The Stones and Brian Jones is streaming on Apple TV Plus, but you can see it in the theater at Lemley's Monica Film Center. It's unrated. Tim, can you give us 20 seconds on A Still Small Voice, the documentary?
A very powerful film about a profession that we don't think much about, the folks who handle hospice care and things like that, chaplains. When I think of chaplains, I think of Dr. McKay in MASH. This follows a young woman as she does her residency as a chaplain, mostly through COVID and what she has to learn about caring.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a beautiful, beautiful film.
Oh, yeah, A Still Small Voice, the documentary at the Lemley Royal in West Los Angeles. Luke Lorenson is the director of the unrated film. Coming up on Film Week, I'll be talking with writer and director Taika Waititi. We'll speak with him about Next Goal Wins, his film, which he adapted from a documentary, the 2014 documentary that was done about the American Samoan soccer team. It's all coming up in just 90 seconds.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.